This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents How to Talk to a Liberal, If You Must. The World According to Ann Coulter, by Ann Coulter. Read for you by the author. How to Talk to a Liberal.
Historically, the best way to convert liberals is to have them move out of their parents' home, get a job, and start paying taxes. But if this doesn't work, you might have to actually argue with a liberal. This is not for the faint of heart. It's important to remember that when arguing with liberals, you are always within inches of the Arab street. Liberals traffic in shouting and demagogy. In a public setting, they will work themselves into a dervish-like trance and start incanting inanities. Bush lied, kids died, racist, fascist, fire Rumsfeld, Halliburton. Fortunately, the street performers usually punch themselves out and are taken back to their parents' house. Also resembling the Arab street, liberals are chock-full of conspiracy theories. They invoke weird personal obsessions like a conversational deus ex machina to trump all facts. You think you're talking about the war in Iraq, and suddenly you start getting a disquisition on Nixon, oil, the neoconservatives, Vietnam. Tom Hayden discusses gang violence in Los Angeles as it relates to Vietnam, or whether Bill O'Reilly's former show, Inside Edition, won the Peabody or the Pinochle Award. This is because liberals, as opposed to sentient creatures, have a finite number of memorized talking points, which they periodically try to shoehorn into unrelated events, such as when Nancy Pelosi opposed the first Gulf War in 1991 on the grounds that it would cause environmental damage in Kuwait. Oddly enough, about half of liberal conspiracy theories involve the Jews, so be prepared for that. A major impediment to arguing with liberals is they refuse to argue. Liberals' idea of a battle of wits is to say Bush lied in front of adoring college audiences and be wildly applauded for their courage. They're like hack road comics who coax a cheap round of applause out of audiences by declaring, "I just quit smoking," or "My wife just had a baby." Without a Roman Colosseum-style audience to give them standing ovations for every idiotic utterance, you get the liberal disappearing act. At a loss, whenever anyone argues back, liberals have a number of stratagems to prevent conservatives from talking. They shout conservatives down, unplug reporters' microphones, edit conservatives' answers in pre-taped TV shows to make the conservative look like a monkey, burn student newspapers, and heckle conservative speakers. When John Stossel went to Brown University for a report on date rape, he was mobbed by angry protesters chanting, "Rape is not TV hype," and then his microphone cord was unplugged by an angry student. College dropout Michael Moore put a microphone in Republican Congressman Mark Kennedy's face and asked for his help in getting more members of Congress to send their own family members to fight the war on terror. Kennedy replied that he would love to and that he already had two nephews in the military, one on his way to Afghanistan. Moore's documentary shows Kennedy's image but cuts his answer from the film. There is probably no conservative newspaper in the country that has not been trashed or burned by liberals. Meanwhile, there's no known instance of college Republicans burning or trashing liberal student newspapers. To the contrary, conservatives get a kick out of watching liberals try to thrash their way to a coherent argument. Bush lied, kids died. In fact, if it weren't for conservatives with a taste for schadenfreude, literally no one would be listening to Air America, assuming it's still on the air by the time this book hits the stores. Life was much better for liberals when there were only three TV stations airing precious little news. Back in the pre-cable news days, public political debate consisted exclusively of liberal Democrats debating radical Democrats. Now that conservatives are physically present on cable news, liberals are terrified they might have to respond to a conservative point. So liberals filibuster and interrupt, hoping to never hear it. Turn on your TV right now and you'll see a liberal, probably Julian Epstein, trying to filibuster his way out of having to respond to a conservative. If you can somehow force a liberal into a point-counterpoint argument, his retorts will bear no relation to what you said, unless you were, in fact, talking about your looks, your age, your weight, your personal obsessions, or whether you are a fascist. In the famous liberal two-step, they leap from one idiotic point to the next so you can never nail them. It's like arguing with someone with attention deficit disorder. Inasmuch as liberals can only win arguments when no one is allowed to argue back, they enjoy creating fictional worlds in movies and on TV where liberals finally get to win. Remember the Andy Hardy movies? Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland would be headed for disaster until Andy shouted out, "I tell you what, let's put on a play." With liberals, it's, "We're losing on the facts, let's make a movie." In movies, liberals are invariably morally and intellectually superior. They are also good-looking, witty, compassionate, and always right. Basically, Bob Burr, Jerry Nadler, Al Franken, and Hillary Clinton rolled into one adorable bunch. Only in Hollywood is Robert Redford considered a dead ringer for Bob Woodward, Emma Thompson for Hillary Clinton, Dustin Hoffman for Carl Bernstein, and Andy Garcia for Al Franken. Typically, Republicans are played by hard-boiled B-list types whose only other roles are as cruel high school football coaches or rogue army drill instructors. Reflect on the fact that Anthony Hopkins played both Nixon and Hannibal Lecter. The only policemen in the universe who are not aware that cop-killer bullets have never killed a cop are the ones on Law and Order. Only in liberal fantasy movies like Coming Home is a patriotic hawk the impotent klutz who shoots himself in the foot, and the liberal dove the sexually potent one. Only in Hollywood could a sitcom that parodies a U.S. president and is titled There's My Bush be a movie about George Bush rather than Bill Clinton. The show was unceremoniously and quietly canceled because of low ratings. In movies, we always learn that there is no reason ever to fight a war. Unless the Earth is invaded by aliens from outer space with huge scary spaceships and death rays, and men of all races and nationalities can unite against a common enemy, like an Independence Day. So if the Earth is ever invaded by hostile aliens from outer space, you won't have to ask liberals twice to take up arms in defense of planet Earth. It was inevitable, given what liberals value, that on the popular sitcom Friends, beautiful actresses would be depicted hyperventilating over George Stephanopoulos' fictional manhood when he drops his fictional towel. Only in the bizarro world of Hollywood can such a harmless little chap as George exude massive sexual potency. On HGTV, the female host of What Not to Wear leeringly jokes about seeing Bill Clinton in a Speedo. In real life, Monica Lewinsky can be heard on tape describing Clinton's executive branch thus. Think of a thumb. No wonder liberals prefer the world of make-believe. In addition to all Oliver Stone movies and all Michael Moore documentaries, Oliver Stone without the talent, an extremely abbreviated list of liberal fantasy movies includes The Day After Tomorrow, not to be confused with Next Friday, starring Ice Cube. Message, liberals are right about global warming. The hyper-silly disaster epic is based on a book co-authored by UFO, Black Helicopter, The CIA is Beaming Microwaves into My Teeth Fillings Guru, and late-night AM radio maven Art Bell. The Cider House Rules. Message, liberals are right about abortion. Kindly small-town abortionist Michael Caine just wants to help unwed pregnant girls. Disaster strikes when it turns out the young lad taking over Caine's practice, Toby Maguire, is opposed to abortion because it's wrong. The lad soon learns the error of his ways after a black teenage girl from a family of apple pickers is raped and impregnated by her own father and needs an abortion. You can't remind people too often that most women having abortions were raped by their own fathers. This film was a veritable ode to moral relativism and the hideous notion that there are no rules save the ones we make up ourselves as we go along. Shockingly, it only won a single Oscar. The American President. Message. Democrats will vote their consciences even when it hurts them politically, and all Republicans ever do is call people names. In this movie, Michael Douglas plays Bill Clinton as Clinton would like to be, handsome, thin, courageous, liberal, and widowed. The president's top Republican adversary goes on national TV and calls the president's girlfriend a whore, so it's a plausible story. Dave. Message. Liberals are right about federal spending on the homeless. Only the president can put an end to homelessness, and he's got to cut $500 million in pork from the discretionary budget to do so. He finds the money by poring over the entire federal budget, during an all-nighter, with the help of his tax guy, played by Charles Grodin. Of course, to do that, the president would need a line-item veto. Now, which party do you suppose supports a line-item veto, and which opposes it? Of the dozens and dozens of nonfiction books to come out about the Clinton presidency, only one was made into a movie, The Hunting of the President, by fanatical Clinton apologists Joe Connison and Gene Lyons. Message, liberals were right about Clinton, even if there are only two liberals left defending him. The intriguing plot line is this: a lot of mean people tried to bring down a great president. Leaving aside which account most closely resembles the truth, which of these sounds like a better movie plot? Movie plot A. Through the freak accident of a third-party candidacy, a lying horn dog Jimmy Swaggart type somehow ends up as President of the United States. As his Eva Perón-style wife tries to socialize all industry, the president gallivants with Hollywood starlets, has repeated affairs, accepts illegal campaign donations from foreign enemies, and uses the vast powers of the federal government to frighten and intimidate the people who get in his way. Some end up dead, some have their secret FBI files pored over by a former bar bouncer, some are audited by the IRS. He is finally brought down when he ejaculates on an intern's dress and lies about it under oath, and it turns out the intern has kept the dress. Movie plot B. For no reason whatsoever, a few oddball private citizens develop a deep personal antipathy for a third-way, moderate Democratic president. Amazingly, Hollywood actually made a movie, Bob Roberts, in which the slick cosmetic tricks of the sophisticated right-wing political machine hoodwinked the American people. So that's why liberals are losing all the arguments in real life. Since cable news has begun forcing liberals to confront opposing points of view in real life, rather than movie scripts where the Republicans' only argument is to call the president's girlfriend a whore, liberals have been trying to drop emotionalism as their main argument. Their new posture is mock hard-headed realism. Now they begin sentences with phrases like, "the fact of the matter is," or "experts say," followed by comically false assertions. Liberals flex their spindly little muscles and announce that everything that used to make them cry, gun ownership, racial profiling, missile defense, school vouchers, torturing terror suspects, simply doesn't work. The fact is, it doesn't work, and this is according to several studies, and no, you can't see them, why would you ask? After 19 nearly identical-looking Muslim men hijacked 4 airplanes and murdered 3,000 Americans, people weren't in much of a mood for liberal preachiness about racial profiling. So instead of crying and trying to make Americans feel guilty, liberals pretended to be hard-headed realists. Asked if there was anything wrong with ethnic profiling at airports after 9/11, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz said, "Yes, it doesn't work." Other better ideas, he said, were face recognition technology and national ID cards. These would work great if only we knew who the terrorists were. But if we knew who the terrorists were, the only plane they'd be boarding would be headed to Guantanamo, and we wouldn't need to search anyone at all. On CNN, Juliette Kayyem, from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, assured viewers that no one is disagreeing with extra scrutiny for potential terrorists. But profiling, she said, won't work. It wouldn't work, allegedly, because Al-Qaeda exists in places from Algeria to Zimbabwe. True, but since we're in America, wouldn't it be a big help if we could screen out most of the Americans? Liberals think "it doesn't work" has such a nice ring to it that the patent absurdity of what they're saying should not detract from their argument. After Senator Teddy Kennedy tried to block federal funding for the government's program to fingerprint and photograph people entering the country from 25 Muslim nations, his sleazy backdoor maneuver was defended on Fox News Channel's O'Reilly Factor by Sarah El-Tantawi of the objective, nonpartisan, well-groomed Muslim Public Affairs Council. El-Tantawi said it was a huge mischaracterization to think she was going to complain about racial profiling. "That's not the argument I'm here to make." To the contrary, her objection, and Kennedy's objection, was that fingerprinting immigrants from terrorist-producing countries is, quote, "completely inefficient." And we all know how Teddy Kennedy cannot abide inefficiency. Elizabeth Rinskoff Parker, former legal counsel to the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the State Department, has been quoted as saying, "We don't use torture because it doesn't work." And it only took a little arm-twisting to get her to say that. Torturing randomly chosen people on the off chance that they might be up to something, as was routinely done in liberals' favorite country, the USSR, clearly doesn't work. Torturing the guy you know for a fact as withholding information actually works quite well. There may be good and sufficient moral reasons for not torturing people for information, but efficacy is not among them. After decades of womanly crying about guns, liberals admitted their earlier hysteria had been much ado about nothing. The real problem with guns was they don't make people any safer. Fox News Channel's Alan Combs said to Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America, "Let's talk about some cold hard facts, Larry. The fact of the matter is, Larry," there's that fact of the matter qualifier I promised you, "that the odds that a home will be the scene of a homicide are much greater if there's a gun in the home." Soccer moms across America shot straight up and said, "I did not know that." The study behind this flagrantly dishonest cold hard fact assumed that anyone killed by a gun in the vicinity of a home where anyone owned a gun was killed by a gun in the home. The specious study merely attests to the fact that people who live in high-crime neighborhoods tend to own guns. As the inestimable economist John Lott says, on that theory of causation, hospitals must cause people to die because lots of people die after being admitted to a hospital. It's as if liberals held focus groups on how to best present their ridiculous ideas and were told, "Passion you've got. But what respondents say you lack is intellection, thinking things through, understanding elementary human nature, and a basic awareness of what people are like." If conservatives have not yet persuaded liberals to give up on socialism and treason, we've at least gotten them to fake linear thinking. Liberals' other new hobby is to call people liars. After years of defending Clinton, they love the piquant irony of calling Bush a liar. Bush said he was a reformer with results. Liar. For 50 years, liberals have called Republicans every name in the book. Idiots, fascists, anti-Semites, racists, crooks, constitution shredders, and masterminds of Salvadoran death squads. Only recently have they added the epithet liar. Even noted ethicist Al Franken has switched from calling conservatives big fat idiots to calling them liars. This is virgin territory for Democrats. They never before viewed lying as a negative. Their last president, Bill Clinton, was called an unusually good liar by a senator in his own party, and their last vice president, Al Gore, couldn't say pass the salt without claiming to have invented salt. Having only recently discovered the intriguing new concept of lies, the Democrats are having a jolly old time calling Bush a liar. But they can't quite grasp the concept of a lie as connoting something that is intentionally untrue, or untrue at all. About the time Baghdad was erupting in celebrations after receiving the news that Uday and Qusay were dead, liberals were still hopping mad that in January 2003, President Bush had uttered the indisputably true fact that British intelligence believed Saddam Hussein had tried to acquire uranium from Africa. That was, and still is, believed by British intelligence. It also was, and still is, the conclusion of our own national intelligence estimate. The CIA, however, discounts this piece of intelligence. The CIA did such a bang-up job predicting 9/11, the Democrats have decided to put all their faith in it. They believe the nation must not act until absolutely every agency and every American is convinced we are about to be nuked. Would that they had such strict standards for worrying about nuclear power plants at home. Sharing a chummy laugh about Republicans on Meet the Press, NBC's Tim Russert asked Senator Joe Biden what the Republicans would have done if a Democratic president had uttered 16 mistaken words about national security in the State of the Union speech. Senator Biden said, "This is going to be counterintuitive for Biden to show his Irish instinct to restrain myself. You know the answer, I know the answer, the whole world knows the answer. They would have ripped his skin off." At least Bush put it in his own words, if you know what I mean. Perhaps Biden is annoyed that Bush merely cited the head of the British Labour Party rather than plagiarized him. Back to Russert's challenge, I shall dispense with Clinton's most renowned lies. Every Democrat commits adultery and lies about it. Fine, they've convinced me. Clinton also lied every time he said, "God bless America," and I don't recall any Republican ever ripping his skin off about that. But how about a lie in a major national speech slandering your own country? In Clinton's acceptance speech at the 1996 Democratic National Convention, he said, "We still have too many Americans who give in to their fears of those who are different from them. Not so long ago, swastikas were painted on the doors of some African-American members of our special forces at Fort Bragg." Folks, for those of you who don't know what they do, the special forces are just what the name says. They are special forces. If I walk off this stage tonight and call them on the telephone and tell them to go halfway around the world and risk their lives for you, and be there by tomorrow at noon, they will do it. They do not deserve to have swastikas on their doors. Clinton was referring to an alleged act of racism in which the prime suspect was one of the alleged victims, a black soldier known for filing repeated complaints of racism. The fact that the leading suspect in an apparently racist incident was himself black had already been widely reported in the press. The soldier, not a member of the special forces, by the way, was later discharged. And yet Clinton lied about the swastika episode in speech after speech, including his speech at the Democratic National Convention, publicly citing a phony hate crime in order to accuse white special forces members of racism. And he used a lot more than 16 words to do it. Democrats didn't mind a president telling lies in order to defame his own country. They reserve their outrage for a president who defames the name of an honorable statesman like Saddam Hussein. Note to the Democrats, just because you defended Bill Clinton doesn't mean you have to defend every government official credibly accused of rape. How dare Bush suggest that Saddam was seeking uranium from Africa on the flimsy evidence of the findings of British intelligence, the findings of our own national intelligence estimate, the fact that Israel blew up Saddam's last nuclear reactor in 1981, and the fact that we learned about Saddam's reconstitution of his nuke program only in 1996 when his son-in-law briefly defected to Jordan. The Mr. Magoos from the UN Weapons Inspection Team had missed this fact while scouring the country for 5 years after Gulf War I. Apparently it's okay to get the facts wrong, but only in the service of slandering America, the country we're supposed to believe liberals love. Most of this book will explain how to argue with liberals by example, not exegesis. But there are some useful pointers. Here are 10 simple rules to keep in mind. First, don't surrender out of the gate. This is a highly controversial approach among Republican politicians, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't already have a bipartisan consensus for the proposition that you should send half of what you earn to the government. Liberals always want to shame Republicans into making core concessions before the debate begins. You raise taxes, and then we'll discuss cutting spending. You admit the war in Iraq was a failure, and then we'll argue about how to get out of it. You give us abortion on demand, then we'll discuss parental notification. Never has any good come out of surrendering before negotiations begin. Second, unless you were in the Ku Klux Klan like Vanity Fair's Profiles in Courage winner, Senator Bob Byrd, or you killed a woman like Senator Ted Kennedy, or you are credibly accused of rape by Juanita Broderick on NBC News within weeks of being impeached like you-know-who, you don't need to be defensive. Come to think of it, since our side does not accept Klansmen, murderers, or rapists, this rule may be simplified to, don't be defensive. Third, you must outrage the enemy. If the liberal you're arguing with doesn't become speechless with sputtering, impotent rage, you're not doing it right. People don't get angry when lies are told about them. They get angry when the truth is told about them. If you are not being called outrageous by liberals, you're not being outrageous enough. Start with the maximum assertion about liberals and then push the envelope, because, as we know, their evil is incalculable. They stand for the godless rule of dictators. They apologize for abortion, adultery, and everything bestial in society. They support Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, as they once supported Stalin and Mao. They put Stalin apologist Paul Robeson on a stamp. Robeson is David Duke in blackface. This Stalin Peace Prize winner turned his back on Jewish refuseniks in the Soviet Union. After Joseph Stalin's death, he wrote a tribute to the dictator titled, "To You, Beloved Comrade." Most unforgivable of all, liberals have extended the public career of Martin Sheen by at least a full decade. The latest fashions dictated from European capitals ensure that hating America is haute couture. Gwyneth Paltrow and Madonna, with their European homes, European husbands, and European accents, are demonstrating the same unblinking devotion to America's enemies that we have seen in the past. Interestingly, the fake British accent Madonna uses in real life is better than the one Paltrow uses in her movies. This crowd is always in search of approval from people who want to harm America. Nothing too extreme can be said about liberals because it's all true. That's why I almost called this book, "You Don't Know the Half of It." Fourth, never apologize, at least not for what liberals want you to apologize for. These are the people who think Linda Tripp should apologize to the nation, but Bill Clinton was a hapless victim. After Dick Clark had the audacity to apologize to the McWidows on behalf of the U.S. government, liberals started demanding President Bush apologize for 9/11 too. Suddenly, public apologies had become trendy, the thing to do, like getting drunk and having unprotected public sex with Colin Farrell. Instead of fighting the war on terrorism, liberals would prefer a cabinet-level department of closure to handle issues like presidential apologies, with headquarters in a building shaped like a giant hug and Dr. Phil as Secretary of Closure. Fifth, never compliment a Democrat. Unfortunately, when dealing with liberals, you have to set aside everything your mother told you about giving compliments. Mother is wise about many things, and when you go over to Mrs. Jaworski's house, you should still compliment her on her rose bushes. But that doesn't mean you should ever say anything nice about a Democrat. For one thing, it's such a colossal waste of time racking your brain trying to think up nice things to say to a liberal. "Gee, your head doesn't seem quite as large and misshapen as usual today, Senator Kennedy." But more important, compliments to Democrats are always returned with insults. On any television political roundtable, you will see Republican politicians droning on about what a fine human being some heinous Democrat is and what a pleasure it was to work with him, only to have the heinous Democrat turn around and accuse the Republicans of near complicity in genocide. Consider the first statements out of the mouths of three senators on Larry King Live on May 7, 2004. Senator John Warner, Republican of Virginia. "First, if I may say of my colleagues on the committee, and 24 senators out of the 25 were present at that hearing, I think we comported ourselves individually and collectively as best I've ever seen it in the Senate." Senator John Kyle, Republican of Arizona. "I agree with Senator Warner that the senators comported themselves well for the most part." Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa. "Well, Rumsfeld should resign for a couple of reasons." A few days later, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham used about half his allotted time on Meet the Press to make clear he had absolutely no criticisms of the Democrats. "I didn't come here to beat on Senator Kerry or to defend any political position. This is not about Republican and Democratic politics. Let's show the world that Republicans and Democrats may disagree on the policy and the war in Iraq, but we have the ability to make sure those accountable are going to be held accountable. Republicans and Democrats need to come together to prove to the world that our system works." The Democrats on the panel returned the love by accusing President Bush of responsibility for the Abu Ghraib prison abuse and saying the mission in Iraq would probably fail. Sixth, never show graciousness toward a Democrat. Rules 5, 6, and 7 may seem similar, but I want to be sure I've covered all the bases. Not only will any kindness not be returned, but it will be used against you. President Bush has repeatedly learned the hard way what happens when you are gracious with Democrats. After it leaked that the dignified staff of the dignified former president had trashed the White House on its way out, Bush downplayed the property damage, saying, "There might have been a prank or two, maybe somebody put a cartoon on the wall, but that's okay." If you happen to know anyone moving into the Bush White House who had seen the damage firsthand, you knew it was a lot more than a prank or two. But instead of stopping while they were ahead, pocketing Bush's graciousness and moving on, the Democrats aggressively attacked other Republicans for having falsely impugned the honor of the Clinton White House staff, citing Bush's magnanimity as proof that Republicans had lied about the damage. USA Today ran a snippy article titled, "Ex-Clinton Staffers on Vandalism? Got Proof?" Former Clinton press secretary Jake Seward insinuatingly asked why there were no records of the alleged damage, creating the uniquely ironic scenario of a Clinton spokesman demanding proof of a statement's veracity. Washington Post columnist William Raspberry noted the damage was never cataloged and asked, "Can it be because the alleged vandalism never happened either?" And then a year later, the full GAO report came back. The Party of the People had done $15,000 worth of damage to the People's House. And that didn't even include the cost of cleaning and sterilizing the rugs from Clinton's office. Seventh, never flatter a Democrat. When Bush was first elected, he invited Senator Teddy Kennedy to the White House for movie night to watch the hagiographic Kennedy Snooze Fest 13 days. He named a federal building after one of Kennedy's brothers and gushingly praised the other. He brought Kennedy over to discuss education several times. Hell, he did everything but split a bottle of Chivas Regal with the guy, which, come to think of it, might have actually won Kennedy over. Asked about Bush's overtures, the Fredo of the Kennedy family said, "It takes more than good intentions to make a difference." When specifically asked whether he thought Bush was smart, a meaningless concept in the case of college admissions, but a hard fact in the case of Republican presidents, Kennedy pointedly said he found Bush only engaging and personable. Yes, there's that trademark Kennedy wit and boyish charm. After Bush named the Department of Justice building after Robert Kennedy, Kerry Kennedy Cuomo displayed the celebrated Kennedy graciousness by viciously attacking the Bush administration at the pre-dedication ceremony. Speaking from the podium to her daughter in the audience, Kennedy Cuomo said, "Kara, if anyone tries to tell you this is the type of justice system your grandpa embraced, you just don't believe it." Oddly enough, she didn't add, "Actually, Kara, Grandpa's justice was more like the justice system your great-uncle Teddy turned to after he drowned that girl." This is as we have come to expect from a family of heroin addicts, statutory rapists, convicted and unconvicted female killers, cheaters, bootleggers, and dissolute drunks known as Camelot. Extend an olive branch to the Democrats and they'll smack the living daylights out of you with it, while hugging the tree itself, naturally. Eighth, do not succumb to liberal bribery. Faustian bargains are still not a good deal. Liberals are a seductive group of minxes. They recruit conservatives the way colleges recruit star athletes, deploying celebrity starlets as comfort women. Become a liberal and you'll be lavished with great wealth and adulation. Nationally renowned liberal female journalists have been known to offer oral sex to elected officials just for keeping abortion on demand legal. Liberals have scores of money laundering schemes to pay off anyone who attacks a conservative. Foundation jobs, radio stations, websites, movie options, university professorships, and jobs writing for the New York Times. Lots of goodies are available to any conservative willing to give up all his principles. Imagine Satan's temptation of Daniel Webster if the old Beastmaster had been able to dangle a development deal with TriStar, one of those phony Harvard PhDs, or even a power lunch with Harvey Weinstein in front of Mr. Webster. Go with liberals and they will give you a lifetime of wine, women, and song. The more public and respected a conservative you are, the more goodies will be offered to you, starting with the cover of the New York Times Magazine. Even a halfwit can get a pretty good life out of liberal enticements, rather like a bureaucrat in the old Soviet Union. If a conservative giant like Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity ever became a liberal, there would be parades down Fifth Avenue. At the freshman liberal induction ceremony, Bill Moyers would MC, Bono would sing an original song, Maya Angelou would recite a poem, and Sean Penn would throw out the first punch. Apparently, it's difficult for some people to resist that kind of bribery. weak and frightened conservatives crave liberal approval and will do anything to get it. The telltale sign is how quickly a conservative will publicly attack another conservative. These masters of the featherweight insight especially enjoy deploring evangelical Christians. To do it right, every time you denounce a devout Christian or Jew for being a superstitious, intolerant ignoramus, you must praise radical Islam as a religion of peace. It should have set off warning bells when David Brock, professional reformed conservative, was committed to the psychiatric ward of Sibley Memorial Hospital in Washington, D.C. It's never a good sign when you have to wipe the spittle from your champion's mouth before he goes on TV, as Ed Asner's handlers are discovering even as we speak. But Brock was a former conservative attacking conservatives. So before long, liberals were dragging him out of the quiet room at Sibley so they could give him $2 million to start a liberal website. You cannot starve in America as a liberal. For $2 million, liberals now have a website exposing the shocking fact that conservative opinion columnists have opinions that are conservative. I could have told them that for, say, $100,000. Ninth, prepare for your deepest, darkest secrets to become liberal talking points. Liberals' idea of a good retort to a conservative argument is to investigate your personal life and find out if you're into S&M. So if you have anything to hide, say, if you were married to a gay guy, but he was really, really rich and you knew you could talk him into running for the Senate, you'd best become a liberal. All will be forgiven. In fact, something to hide is often considered a resume enhancer if you're a Democrat. Just ask Bill Clinton, Barney Frank, Marion Barry. But if you're a conservative, prepare to have your every foible unveiled as if you were caught raping kittens. Even if you've led a blameless life, liberals invent absurd stories about you. They will say you're afraid of Cheshire cats and ordered nude statues at the Department of Justice covered with drapery. You'll be sneered at for your former line of work, such as Tom DeLay, who is derisively called the Exterminator, because he used to run a massive pesticide company. This is apparently not nearly as classy as having been an ambulance-chasing lawyer. You will simultaneously be described as ugly and accused of being on TV only because you're pretty. You will be called an anti-Semite and a shill for the Jews. You will be called a homophobe and a faghag. As with their political positions, logical consistency is not liberals' métier. If it gets really ugly, they may even call you a neoconservative, by which liberals mean dirty Jew. Not only will you not be lavished with jobs, money, and celebrity starlets, you'll be unemployable, unpublished, and embarrassed. For good measure, magazines will never ever run an attractive picture of you. Finally, after liberals have done everything they can to destroy your career, you'll be accused of being a conservative only for career advancement. On the bright side, you know you've arrived when liberals start calling you a fag. Curiously, these proponents of tolerance always choose gay as their most searing epithet. Joe McCarthy, J. Edgar Hoover, Matt Drudge, Starr's prosecutors, Linda Tripp's lawyer, Christopher Hitchens, Mel Gibson, all these have been denounced as homosexuals at some point by liberals. The New York Times' Frank Rich, now there's someone who would never be called a homo, outed David Brock when he was still on the right. Rich favorably cited Christopher Hitchens, who himself was called a fag by liberals when he crossed them, for calling Gibson's movie The Passion of the Christ an exercise in sadomasochistic male narcissism. Arguing with liberals instantly becomes a game of gay-baiting musical chairs. We just don't think they should get married. Liberals actually hate homosexuals. 10th, always be open to liberals in transition. Go all out, be at least as hospitable to them as Saddam was to al-Zarqawi. As with al-Qaeda, if you can create second thoughts in just a couple of them, it will be a lot less trouble for the rest of us down the road. Liberals in transition will tend to approach you in hushed tones, repeatedly looking over their shoulders and explaining they have a family to feed. You might not want these guys watching your back in a bar fight, but at least they are trying to be good. People coming out as conservatives for the first time face being ostracized by friends, neighbors, co-workers, even family members. Nurture them and make sure they aren't killed before they can move to the other side. That's when it's most dangerous. When Christopher Hitchens decided not to lie to a congressional aide to protect his friend, Clinton consigliere Sidney Blumenthal, Hitchens was quickly denounced by his former friends as a drunk and a sexual pervert. Imagine the indignity of having a Clinton defender call you a sexual pervert. According to the sworn statements from Hitchens and Hitchens' wife, early in the Monica Lewinsky scandal, before Monica produced the dress, Blumenthal told them that Clinton said Monica Lewinsky was a stalker. But later, when asked by congressional investigators whether he had told anyone that Clinton called Lewinsky a stalker, Blumenthal had said, I didn't mention it to my friends. I certainly never mentioned it to a reporter. Hitchens told the investigators otherwise. For his treachery of declining to perjure himself, Hitchens' erstwhile close friend Alexander Coburn wrote that Hitchens gets a frisson we'd guess to be quasi-sexual in psychological orientation out of the act of tattling or betrayal. The booze has finally got to him. His behavior exhibits all the symptoms of chronic alcoholism. He said Hitchens' statement was probably uttered while a pint of alcohol and gallons of wine were coursing through his bloodstream. Oddest of all, Coburn called Hitchens a terrific fibber. All this for the despicable act of telling the truth. Yes, Coburn and Blumenthal are two of those liberal friends I warned you about earlier. To end on an optimistic note, remember there is some good in everyone. Hitler didn't smoke, for example. British traitor and spy Kim Philby had a pet fox. Even among the staunchest members of the Communist Party, there turned out to be a few good ones. Similarly, the vast majority of liberals are not intentionally sabotaging the nation. In fact, I don't think as many as 20% give a damn about the nation. That 20%, of course, deeply hates America. But the majority of liberals are just trying to sell books, get a TV show, be called brave in the New York Times, sound hip, or get a woman's phone number at an afternoon reception at the Westchester Kabbalah Center. Intentions, of course, do not mitigate disastrous outcomes. If your doctor removes the wrong kidney because he was jet-lagged from a Doctors Without Borders flight with actor Noah Wiley, it makes precious little difference to you. This is why my philosophy on arguing with liberals is, tough love, except I don't love them. In most cases, I don't even like them. In other words, my tough love approach is much like the Democrats' middle-class tax cuts, everything but the last word. I decided to write this book because I have liberals to thank for my career, and I wanted something substantial to throw in their faces. Oops, I mean, I wanted to give something back. The majority of this book will be new to even my most devoted readers, who are able to locate the rare brave newspapers that carry my column. I've included columns too hot to be published until now, along with the editor's rejections. These columns, as well as many columns that caused more than the usual ruckus, like my 9/11 Kill Their Leaders column, I preserved in their original form so you can see what the fuss was about. Even the unretouched columns are my unretouched columns, as they live on my computer, which was not always the same as the published version. I've occasionally run into editors with heavy hands, and I didn't necessarily care for their edits. These are bootlegs, never-released columns, NC-17 versions, lost classics, remixes, extended play versions, and the director's cut. There are many advantages to plumbing my old columns for a Coulterpalooza. For one thing, I'm one of the most unpublished writers in America, except for my books, which sell pretty well. But unless you are on the internet or a subscriber to Human Events, which everyone should read, all but a few intrepid newspaper editors have withheld these columns from you. Also, I have an ad hoc group of fanatical researchers doing fact-checking for me immediately after my columns go up on the internet. If I get someone's middle initial wrong, it will be widely publicized on hundreds of reasonable, calm, objective, nonpartisan websites with names like www.IHateAnnCoulterWithAHotHotHate.com. This is in addition to my fabulous official editor, Greg Melvin at Universal Press Syndicate, who does not consider it a lie to opine that taxes are too high. Also, when you write for a small circulation newspaper like Human Events, your columns are apparently considered community property by other journalists who shamelessly poach your work without the briefest little credit. At least I know who's been reading my stuff. Now you can read the originals. Finally, I like my columns. Unlike liberals who would rather have their old columns defending Ho Chi Minh just go away, I would prefer that my columns be read more widely. This includes columns from over a decade ago and columns deemed unpublishable. In fact, especially the columns deemed unpublishable.
A Muslim by any other name blows up just the same.
Want to make liberals angry? Defend the United States. Below are my columns on the war on terrorism. It's interesting to review how the carping from the treason lobby has evolved during the course of the war. My position hasn't changed since the column I wrote the night of 9/11. For reasons I cannot understand, I'm often asked if I still think we should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. The answer is, now more than ever.
How 9/11 happened.
We don't need a commission to find out how 9/11 happened. The truth is in the timeline. President Carter, Democrat. In 1979, President Carter allowed the Shah of Iran to be deposed by a mob of Islamic fanatics. A few months later, Muslims stormed the U.S. embassy in Iran and took American embassy staff hostage. Carter retaliated by canceling Iranian visas. He eventually ordered a disastrous and humiliating rescue attempt, crashing helicopters in the desert. President Reagan, Republican. The day of Reagan's inauguration, the hostages were released. In 1982, the U.S. embassy in Beirut was bombed by Muslim extremists. President Reagan sent U.S. Marines to Beirut. In 1983, the U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut were blown up by Muslim extremists. Reagan said the United States would not surrender, but Democrats in Congress threw a hissy fit, drafting a resolution demanding that our troops be withdrawn. All seven Democratic presidential candidates called for our troops to be withdrawn. Reagan caved in to Democrat caterwauling in an election year and withdrew our troops, bombing Syrian-controlled areas on the way out. Democrats complained about that, too. In 1985, an Italian cruise ship, the Achille Lauro, was seized and a 69-year-old American was shot and thrown overboard by Muslim extremists. Reagan ordered a heart-stopping mission to capture the hijackers after the Allies promised them safe passage. The daring plan to intercept the hijackers' flight was conceived by Oliver North, later crucified by Democrats over Iran-Contra, and executed by Admiral Frank Kelso, later savaged by Representative Patricia Schroeder for saying hello to his boys at Tailhook. Kelso's boys captured the hijackers and turned them over to the Italians, who then released them to safe harbor in Iraq. On October 5, 1986, a West Berlin discotheque frequented by U.S. servicemen was bombed by Muslim extremists from the Libyan embassy in East Berlin, killing an American. 10 days later, Reagan bombed Libya, despite our dear ally France refusing the use of their airspace. Americans bombed Gaddafi's residence, killing his daughter, and dropped a bomb on the French embassy by mistake. Reagan also stoked a long, bloody war between heinous regimes in Iran and Iraq. All this was while winning a final victory over Soviet totalitarianism. President Bush won, moderate Republican. In December 1988, a passenger jet, Pan Am Flight 103, was bombed over Lockerbie, Scotland by Muslim extremists. President-elect George Bush claimed he would continue Reagan's policy of retaliating against terrorism, but he did not. Without Reagan to ginger up, even Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher went wobbly, saying there would be no revenge for the bombing. In 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. In early 1991, Bush went to war with Iraq the way liberals like, with approval from the UN and the Allies. Still, a majority of Democrats opposed the war. Democrats demanded that our troops stop at Baghdad, but then after 9/11, absurdly complained that Bush didn't finish off the job with Saddam. President Bill Clinton, Democrat. In February 1993, the World Trade Center was bombed by Muslim fanatics, killing five people and injuring hundreds. Clinton did nothing. In October 1993, 18 American troops were killed in a savage firefight in Somalia. The corpse of one American was dragged through the streets of Mogadishu as the Somalian hordes cheered. Clinton responded by ordering our troops home. Osama bin Laden later told ABC News, "The youth realized more than before that the American soldier was a paper tiger, and after a few blows ran in defeat." In November 1995, five Americans were killed and 30 wounded by a car bomb in Saudi Arabia set by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. In June 1996, a U.S. Air Force housing complex in Saudi Arabia was bombed by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. Months later, Saddam attacked the Kurdish-controlled city of Erbil. Clinton lobbed some bombs into Iraq, hundreds of miles from Saddam's forces. In November 1997, Iraq refused to allow UN weapons inspectors to do their jobs and threatened to shoot down a U.S. U-2 spy plane. Clinton did nothing. In February 1998, Clinton threatened to bomb Iraq, but called it off when the United Nations said no. On August 7, 1998, U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. On August 20, Monica Lewinsky appeared for the second time to testify before the grand jury. Clinton responded by bombing Afghanistan and Sudan, severely damaging a camel and an aspirin factory. On December 16th, the House of Representatives prepared to impeach Clinton the next day. Clinton retaliated by ordering major airstrikes against Iraq, described by the New York Times as by far the largest military action in Iraq since the end of the Gulf War in 1991. The only time Clinton decided to go to war with anyone in the vicinity of Muslim fanatics was in 1999, when Clinton attacked Serbians who were fighting Muslim fanatics. In October 2000, our warship, the USS Cole, was attacked by Muslim extremists. Clinton did nothing. President George Bush, too, Republican. Bush came into office telling his national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, he was tired of swatting flies. He wanted to eliminate al-Qaeda. On September 11, 2001, after Bush had been in office for 7 months, 3,000 Americans were murdered in a savage terrorist attack on U.S. soil by Muslim extremists. Since then, Bush has won wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, captured Saddam Hussein, probably killed and certainly immobilized Osama bin Laden, destroyed al-Qaeda's base, and begun to create the only functioning democracy in the Middle East other than Israel. Democrats opposed it all, except their phony support for the war with Afghanistan, which they immediately complained about and said would be a Vietnam quagmire. Now they claim to be outraged that in the months before 9/11, Bush did not do everything Democrats opposed doing after 9/11. What a surprise.
This is War, September 12, 2001.
Barbara Olson kept her cool. In the hysteria and terror of hijackers herding passengers to the rear of the plane, she retrieved her cell phone and called her husband, Ted, the Solicitor General of the United States. She informed him that he had better call the FBI. The plane had been hijacked. According to reports, Barbara was still on the phone with Ted when her plane plunged in a fiery explosion directly into the Pentagon. Barbara risked having her neck slit to warn the country of a terrorist attack. She was a patriot to the very end. This is not to engage in the media's typical hallucinatory overstatement about anyone who is the victim of a horrible tragedy. The furtive cell phone call was an act of incredible daring and panache. If it were not, we'd be hearing reports of hundreds more cell phone calls. Even people who swear to hate cell phones carry them for commercial air travel. The last time I saw Barbara in person was about 3 weeks ago. She generously praised one of my recent columns and told me I'd really found my niche. Ted, she said, had taken to reading my columns aloud to her over breakfast. I mentioned that to say three things about Barbara. First, she was really nice. A lot of people on TV seem nice but aren't. And some who don't seem nice are. But Barbara was always her charming, graceful, ebullient self. Nice is an amazingly rare quality among writers. In the opinion business, bitter jealous hatred is the norm. Barbara had reason to be secure. Second, it was actually easy to imagine Ted reading political columns aloud to Barbara at the breakfast table. Theirs was a relationship that could only be cheaply imitated by Bill and Hillary, the latter being a subject of Barbara's appropriately biting bestseller, Hell to Pay. Hillary claimed preposterously in a Talk magazine interview that she discussed policy with Bill while cutting his grapefruit in the morning. But when asked about Monica Lewinsky, Hillary kept insisting she was waiting for the facts to come out. Couldn't she have asked her husband about the facts while cutting his grapefruit? Ted and Barbara really did talk politics, and really did have breakfast together. It's Ted and Barbara just like it's Fred and Ginger, and George and Gracie. They were so perfect together, so obvious, that their friends were as happy as they were on their wedding day. This is more than the death of a great person and patriotic American. It's a human amputation. Third, since Barbara's compliment, I'd been writing my columns for Ted and Barbara. I'm always writing to someone in my head. Now I don't know who to write to. Ted and Barbara were a good muse. Apart from hearing that this beautiful light had been extinguished from the world, only one other news flash broke beyond the numbingly omnipresent horror of the entire day. That evening, CNN reported that bombs were dropping in Afghanistan, and then updated the report to say they weren't our bombs. They should have been ours. I wanted them to be ours. This is no time to be precious about locating the exact individuals directly involved in this particular terrorist attack. Those responsible include anyone, anywhere in the world, who smiled in response to the annihilation of patriots like Barbara Olson. We don't need long investigations of the forensic evidence to determine with scientific accuracy the person or persons who ordered this specific attack. We don't need an international coalition. We don't need a study on terrorism. We certainly didn't need a congressional resolution condemning the attack this week. The nation has been invaded by a fanatical, murderous cult, and we welcome them. We are so good and so pure, we would never engage in discriminatory racial or religious profiling. People who want our country destroyed live here, work for our airlines, and are submitted to the exact same airport shakedown as a lumberman from Idaho. This would be like having the Wehrmacht immigrate to America and work for our airlines during World War II. Except the Wehrmacht was not so bloodthirsty. All of our lives don't need to change, as they keep prattling on TV. Every single time there is a terrorist attack or a plane crashes because of pilot error, Americans allow their rights to be contracted for no purpose whatsoever. The airport kabuki theater of magnetometers, asinine questions about whether passengers packed their own bags, and the hostile lumpen mesomorphs ripping open our luggage somehow allowed over a dozen armed hijackers to board four American planes almost simultaneously on Bloody Tuesday. Did those fabulous security procedures stop a single hijacker anywhere in America that day? Airports scrupulously applied the same laughably ineffective airport harassment to Susie Chapstick as to Muslim hijackers. It is preposterous to assume that every passenger is a potential crazed homicidal maniac. We know who the homicidal maniacs are. They are the ones cheering and dancing right now. We should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity. We weren't punctilious about locating and punishing only Hitler and his top officers. We carpet-bombed German cities. We killed civilians. That's war, and this is war.
Attack France, December 20, 2001.
As pundits mull whether America's next target in the war on terrorism should be Iraq or smaller quarry first, such as Sudan or Somalia, it's time to consider another petri dish of ferocious anti-American hatred and terrorist activity. The Bush doctrine is we are at war not only with the terrorists, but also with those who harbor them. We've got to attack France. Having exhausted itself in a spirited fight with the Nazis in the last war, France cannot work up the energy to oppose terrorism. For decades now, France has nurtured, coddled, and funded Islamic terrorists. Moreover, the great Satan is getting a little sick of our McDonald's franchises being attacked on behalf of notoriously inefficient French dairy farmers. At the 1972 Olympics, Muslim terrorists assassinated 11 Israeli athletes and one German policeman. 5 years later, acting on intelligence from Israeli secret police, French counter-espionage agents arrested the reputed mastermind of the massacre, Abu Daoud. Both Israel and West Germany sought the extradition of Daoud. Afraid of upsetting Muslim terrorists, France refused on technical grounds and set him free. In 1986, Libyan agents of Muammar Gaddafi planted a bomb in a West Berlin discotheque, killing an American serviceman and a Turkish woman. Hundreds more were injured. President Reagan ordered airstrikes against Libyan military targets, including Gaddafi's living quarters. Quaking in the face of this show of manly force, France denied America the use of its airspace. As a consequence, American pilots were required to begin their missions from air bases in Britain. When the pilots finally made it to Tripoli, tired from the long flights and showing a puckish sense of humor, they bombed the French embassy by mistake. Oops, butterfingers. France has repeatedly decried economic sanctions against Iraq and has accused the United Nations of manufacturing evidence against Saddam Hussein. The UN, not even the great Satan. The French UN ambassador dismissed aerial photographs of Iraqi military trucks fleeing inspection sites just before UN weapons inspectors arrived as, I quote, perhaps a trucker's picnic. Along with the rest of the European Union, France sends millions of dollars to the Palestinian Authority every year. Sucking up to the PA has really paid dividends to the craven butterbellies. While visiting Arafat in Gaza last year to announce several million more dollars in aid, Prime Minister Lionel Jospin was attacked by angry stone-throwing Palestinian students. Earlier this year, France connived with human rights champions China and Cuba to toss the United States off the UN Human Rights Commission. Sudan took America's place, and if its diplomats are not too bogged down with human torture and slave trading, they are very much looking forward to attending the meetings. This summer, Paris made Mumia Abu-Jamal an honorary citizen of Paris. In America's cowboy, bloodlust, rush-to-judgment approach to the death penalty, this convicted Philadelphia cop killer has been sitting on death row, giving radio interviews and college commencement addresses for 20 years. Luckily, Mumia sounds like a Muslim name, so Parisians can keep using the same bumper stickers for the war on terrorism. 2 weeks into America's war in Afghanistan, Le Figaro began calling for American restraint. In polls, 47% of the French said they believed U.S. military action was failing, and only 17% thought it was working, which was, admittedly, 17% more than on the New York Times editorial page. Flaunting France's well-established reputation as a fearsome fighting machine, the French foreign minister, Hubert Védrine, immediately called on the United States to stop bombing Afghanistan. The first indictment to come out of the September 11th attacks was of a French national, Zacharias Moussaoui. He is believed to be the intended 20th hijacker on Bloody Tuesday. France quickly moved to extend consular protection to Moussaoui. Intriguingly, French Justice Minister Marie-Lise Lebranchu has demanded that Moussaoui not be executed. Mademoiselle Lebranchu seems to have forgotten, but we are the great Satan. We also have Moussaoui. It's annoying enough when these celebrated Nazi slayers refuse to extradite terrorists on the grounds that America does not observe the pristine judicial formalities of their pals China, Cuba, and Sudan. But under what zany theory of international law does France think it can tell us what to do with a terrorist we caught right here on U.S. soil? The great Satan is wearying of this reverse hegemony, in which little pipsqueak nations try to impose their little pipsqueak values on us. Aren't we the ones who should be arrogantly oppressing countries that unaccountably do not have the death penalty? And now, as America goes about building support for an attack on Iraq, guess who's complaining again? The turtleneck chickens are terrified of offending fanatical Muslims. Meanwhile, we are asking Arab leaders to face down the vastly larger populations of crazies living in their countries, while France whines, predominantly Muslim Turkey, is preparing its airstrips for a possible U.S. attack on Iraq. If this is a war against terrorism and not a Eurocentric war against Islam, the conclusion is ineluctable. We must attack France. What are they going to do, fight us?
Beauty pageants can be murder. November 28, 2002.
The Religion of Peace suffered another PR setback this week when Muslims in Nigeria welcomed the Miss World beauty pageant by slaughtering Christians in the street and burning churches to the ground. At last count, more than 200 people were dead, hundreds more were injured, and thousands were left without homes. Also, the Nigerian contestants' chances of winning Miss Congeniality were cruelly dashed. Leaping at the one chance they had to attract positive press to their pissant country and begin the process of dragging themselves out of the 13th century, Nigerian Muslims instead chose to hack innocent people to death in the name of Allah. Pageant officials pulled up stakes and immediately took the show to London. One assumes the director of the Nigerian Department of Tourism isn't pleased. Winning the pageant site had been an uphill battle from the beginning. Some of the more closed-minded Miss World participants were already carping about the upcoming stoning of a Nigerian woman, in accordance with Islamic Sharia law. The president of Nigeria tried to downplay the Muslims' murderous rampage by cheerfully explaining, "The beauty queens should not feel they are the cause of the violence. It could happen any time irresponsible journalism is committed against Islam." Well, that's a relief. It seems an article in a Nigerian newspaper had mused that the Prophet Muhammad would probably have chosen a wife from among the Miss World contestants. This upset the practitioners of the Religion of Peace, and for good reason. Their polygamous prophet actually preferred his wives a little younger. One of Muhammad's wives was 6 years old. Muslims reacted to the article by bludgeoning, stabbing, and burning Christians to death. Some enforcers of the Religion of Peace in Nigeria ordered Muslims to kill the author of this blasphemy. Overheard at Miss World contest, "Does this make me look fatwa?" As long as liberals are going to keep demanding that Americans refer to Islam as a religion of peace, it would be a big help if Muslims would stop killing people. The New York Times simply refuses to admit that their little darlings, angry, violent Muslims, could ever be at fault for killing people. That makes no sense because Islam is a religion of peace. The Times reviewed the facts and the slaughter during the Miss World contest, processed them through a PC prism, and came to the conclusion that Islam is peaceful, but religion causes violence. Thus, according to the Times headline, "Religious violence in Nigeria drives out Miss World event." It wasn't Muslims killing people, it was non-specific religious violence. The article explained that Muslims pouring out of mosques to kill Christians and torch churches in Nigeria resulted from the tinderbox of religious passions in the country. The police step in to try to quell rioting Muslims, and the Times reports this as fighting between Christians and Muslims. Ah, the cycle of violence. Religion causes violence, and never mind that the most bloodthirsty cult in the 20th century was an atheistic sect known as communism. It was not true communism, and Muslim terrorists are not practicing true Islam. Ironically, liberals would hate Muslims who practice true Islam. Without the terrorism, Muslims are just another group of anti-choice fanatics. Winning Best in Show was the Times headline on an article about the Christian missionary shot dead in Lebanon by a Muslim. "Killing underscores enmity of evangelists and Muslims." This is like referring to the enmity between a woman and her rapist. She hates him, he hates her. It's a cycle of violence. Except the funny thing about the Christians is, they still love the Muslims. The Muslims' main beef with the Christians was, I quote, "Christians destroy the fighting spirit of the children, especially of the Palestinian youth, by teaching them not to fight the Jews, teaching the Palestinians to forgive the Jews and leave them Jerusalem." The Times seemed to agree that the Muslims had a point with the evangelical. Just as no new data can shake the Times' belief that Islam is a religion of peace, Nothing can disabuse them of the idea that Christians, as a general matter, deserve to be shot. In a news analysis, The Times said the missionaries claimed they were merely exposing people to Jesus Christ. But, The Times said, in a j'accuse tone, a somewhat more direct goal emerges amid the website postings. The Times had caught the Christians red-handed committing irresponsible web postings against Islam. They were asking for it. On the bright side, at least this means The Times is holding the gun innocent in this one instance. Luckily for The Times, Christians do not rip out people's entrails in response to irresponsible journalism committed against Christianity.
War-torn Democrats, January 29, 2003.
Last week, Senator John Kerry gave a speech saying, "Mr. President, do not rush to war." Rush to war? We've been talking about this war for a year. It's been 3 months since Kerry duly recorded his vote in favor of a war resolution to forcibly remove Saddam Hussein from power. In 1991, Kerry voted against the Gulf War, saying the country was not yet ready for what it will witness and bear if we go to war. Having been taunted for that vote and that prediction ever since, this time Kerry made sure to vote in favor of war with Iraq. This will allow the New York Times to describe him as a moderate Democrat forevermore. Indeed, a surprisingly large number of Democrats voted for the war resolution last October. But as soon as the November elections were over, Democrats like Kerry began aggressively attacking the very war they had just voted for. These Democrats want to have it both ways. If the war goes well, a lot of them voted for war with Iraq, didn't they? But if the war does not go well, many of the very Democrats who voted for the war resolution will have emerged as leading spokesmen for the anti-war position. A vote for the war surrounded by Neville Chamberlain foot-dragging is a fraud. The Neville Chamberlain Democrats are now claiming they didn't realize what they were voting for. John Kerry says he thought a resolution authorizing the president to use force against Iraq meant that the United Nations would have to approve. Dianne Feinstein said she voted for the resolution, assuming it meant we would invade only if our allies approved. Joe Biden made the terrific argument that if we don't wait for UN approval, it would make a mockery of the efficacy of the UN. The Democrats appear to be the only people who still believe there is any efficacy to the UN. In any event, I believe the United Nations should be more worried about that consequence than we should. Kerry claims he is still four square behind disarming Saddam Hussein, but not until we have exhausted the remedies available, built legitimacy, and earned the consent of the American people, absent, of course, an imminent threat requiring urgent action. As George Bush pointed out in his State of the Union address, dictators are not in the habit of politely putting us on notice before they strike. By the time a threat is imminent, the capital will be gone. That's the short version. The long version of Kerry's position is this. If you have a breach that, by everybody's standard, at least in the United States, those of us in the House and the Senate and the President join together and make a judgment, this is indeed a material breach, and then others, some of them can't be persuaded, if we have evidence sufficient to show the materiality of the breach, we should be able to do what Adlai Stevenson did on behalf of the administration, Kennedy administration, and sit in front of the Security Council and say, "Here is the evidence. It's time for all of you to put up. We need to all do this together." And that's what I think the resolution that was passed suggests. There's a call to arms to unite the Democrats. If there has been a material breach, by everybody's standard, then and only then, can we boldly go to the United Nations. This is the fundamental problem of the anti-war movement. They can't bring themselves to say it's a mistake to depose Saddam Hussein, and "don't hurry" is not much of a rallying cry. Why not hurry? Democrats claim they haven't seen proof yet that Saddam is a direct threat to the United States. For laughs, let's suppose they're right. In the naysayers' worst-case scenario, the United States would be acting precipitously to remove a ruthless dictator who tortures his own people, gassed the Kurds, and allows his sons to operate rape rooms. As Bush said after detailing some of Saddam Hussein's charming practices, "If this is not evil, then evil has no meaning." It's not as if anyone is worried that through some horrible miscalculation we could be removing the Iraqi Abraham Lincoln by mistake. Either we're removing a dictator who currently has plans to fund terrorism against American citizens, or, if Bush is completely wrong and Eleanor Clift is completely right, we're just removing a dictator who plans to terrorize a lot of people in the region, but not Americans specifically. Even for someone like me who doesn't want America to be the world's policeman, the risk of precipitous action against Saddam Hussein doesn't keep me up at night. The Democrats' jejune claim that Saddam Hussein is not a threat to our security presupposes that they would care if he were. Who are they kidding? Democrats adore threats to the United States. Bush got a raucous standing ovation at his State of the Union address when he announced that, "This year, for the first time, we are beginning to field a defense to protect this nation against ballistic missiles." The excitement was noticeably muted on the Democrat side of the aisle. The vast majority of Democrats remained firmly in their seats, sullen at the thought that America would be protected from incoming ballistic missiles. To paraphrase George Bush, "If this is not treason, then treason has no meaning."
We don't care. June 4, 2003.
Liberals have started in with their female taunting about weapons of mass destruction. The way they carry on, you would think they had caught the Bush administration in some shocking mendacity. You know how the left can't stand a liar. For the sake of their tiresome argument, let's stipulate that we find no weapons of mass destruction. Or, to be accurate, no more weapons of mass destruction. Perhaps Hussein was using the 3 trucks capable of assembling poison gases to sell ice cream under some heretofore undisclosed UN Oil for Popsicles program. Should we apologize and return the country to Saddam Hussein and his winsome sons? Should we have him on Designer's Challenge to put his palaces back in all their 80s Vegas splendor? Or maybe Uday and Kusei could spruce up each other's rape rooms on a very special episode of Trading Spaces. What is liberals' point? No one cares. The question was never whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We know he had weapons of mass destruction because he used weapons of mass destruction against the Kurds, against the Iranians, against his own people. The United Nations weapons inspectors repeatedly found Saddam's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after the 1991 Gulf War, right up until Saddam threw them out in 1998. Justifying his impeachment day bombing, Clinton cited the Iraqi regime's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs. Indeed, to date, this constitutes the only evidence that Saddam didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Bill Clinton said he did. Liberals are now pretending that their position all along was that Saddam had secretly disarmed in the last few years without telling anyone. But that wasn't liberals' position, though it would finally explain the devilish question of why Saddam thwarted inspectors every inch of the way for 12 years, issued phony reports to the UN, and wouldn't allow flyovers or unannounced inspections. It was because he had nothing to hide. Liberals also have to pretend that the only justification for war given by the Bush administration was that Iraq was knee-deep in nukes, anthrax, biological weapons, and chemical weapons, so much so that even Hans Blix couldn't help but notice them. But that wasn't the Bush administration's position. Rather, it was that there were lots of reasons to get rid of Saddam Hussein and none to keep him. When President Bush gave the Hussein regime 48 hours' notice to quit Iraq, he said, "All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end." He said to the Iraqi people, "There would be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors, no more poison factories, no more executions of dissidents, no more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near." Liberals kept saying, "That's too many reasons." The New York Times leading hysteric, Frank Rich, complained, "We know Saddam Hussein is a thug and we want him gone, but the administration has never stuck to a single story in arguing the case for urgent preemptive action now." Since liberals never print retractions, they can say anything. What they said in the past is always deemed inadmissible and unfair to quote. Contrary to their current self-advertisements, it was liberals who were citing Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, and with gusto, in order to argue against war with Iraq. They said America would suffer retaliatory strikes, there would be mass casualties, Israel would be nuked, our troops would be hit with Saddam's chemical weapons, and it would be a Vietnam quagmire. Their position was, all we needed to do was disarm him, which would have required a military occupation of Iraq and a systematic inspection of 1,000 or so known Iraqi weapon sites without interference from the Hussein regime. In other words, pretty much what we're doing right now. That's why liberals were so smitten with the idea of relying on UN weapons inspectors. As their title indicates, weapons inspectors inspect weapons. They don't stop torture, abolish rape rooms, feed the people, topple Saddam's statues, or impose democracy. In January of this year, the New York Times' Nicholas Kristof cited the sort of dismal CIA report that always turns up in the hands of New York Times reporters, warning that Saddam might order attacks with weapons of mass destruction as his last chance to exact vengeance by taking a large number of victims with him. Kristof said he opposed invading Iraq simply as a matter of the costs and benefits of an invasion, concluding we should not invade because there was clearly a significant risk that it would make America less safe. In his native tongue, Weaselese, Kristof claimed he would be gung-ho for war if only he were convinced we could oust Saddam with minimal casualties and quickly establish a democratic Iraq. We've done that, and now he's angry that his predictions of calamity didn't come true. That's Bush's fault, too. Christoph says Bush manipulated evidence of weapons of mass destruction, an act of duplicity he calls, quote, just as alarming, end quote, as a brutal dictator who has weapons of mass destruction. If Americans were lied to, they were lied to by liberals who warned we would be annihilated if we attacked Iraq. The left's leading intellectual light, Janine Garofalo, was featured in an anti-war commercial before the war, saying, if we invade Iraq, there's a United Nations estimate that says there will be up to 500,000 people killed or wounded. Now they're testy because they realize Saddam may never have had even a sporting chance to kill hundreds of thousands of Americans.
How to Lose a War, September 10, 2003.
Vermont Governor Howard Dean has been issuing diatribes against the Bush administration that would beat Tariq Aziz with severe menstrual cramps. This strategy has made him the runaway favorite of the Democratic Party. Even Mr. War Hero John Kerry is getting shellacked by Dean. At times, Kerry seems almost ready to surrender, making him look even more French. If only Kerry had a war record or an enormously rich spouse to fall back on. In the wake of Dean's success, the entire Democratic Dream Team is beginning to talk like Dr. Demento. On the basis of their recent pronouncements, the position of the Democratic Party seems to be that Saddam Hussein did not hit us on 9/11, Halliburton did. Explaining his vote for a war that he then immediately denounced, Kerry recently said his vote was just a head fake, leading some to wonder how many of Kerry's other votes in the U.S. Senate this would explain. He voted for war only to bluff Saddam Hussein into letting in the U.N. weapons inspectors. It was right to have a threat of force, Kerry said, because it's only the threat of force that got Hans Blix and the inspectors back in the country. But he never imagined that Bush would interpret the open-ended war resolution as grounds to start an actual war. The difference is, Kerry said, I would have worked with the United Nations. None of the Democrats has the guts to come out and demand that the United States turn tail and run when the going gets tough. If only one of them had the courage to demand cowardice like a real Democrat. Instead, they stamp their feet and demand that Bush go to the United Nations. Apparently, it is urgent that we replace the best fighting force in the world with an international peacekeeping force, a task force both feared and respected worldwide for its ability to distribute powdered cheese to poor children. Inconsolable that their pleas to work through the UN did not stop Bush from invading Iraq and deposing Saddam Hussein, now the Democrats are eager for the UN to get involved so it can wreck the rebuilding process. Since we didn't let the UN lose the war for us, the least we can do is let them screw up the peace. The idea that we would involve those swine in the post-war occupation of Iraq is so preposterous that it's under serious consideration as next week's slogan for the Howard Dean campaign. I hesitate to raise it to the level of a serious argument by offering a rebuttal, but as luck would have it, we have two models for how to occupy a country after a war. I hate to give away the ending, but getting the Allies involved is not the successful model. After World War II, the United States ran the Japanese occupation unilaterally. Without the meddling of other nations, the Japanese occupation went off without a hitch. Within 5 years, General Douglas MacArthur had imposed a constitutional democracy on Japan with a bicameral legislature, a Bill of Rights, and an independent judiciary. Now the only trouble Japan causes us is its insistence on selling cars and small trucks to Americans at good prices. By contrast, the German occupation was run as liberals would like to run post-war Iraq, a joint affair among the Allies, the United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. It took 45 years to clean up the mess that created. The Soviets bickered with the French, refusing to treat them as allies, on the admittedly sensible grounds that they didn't fight. While plundering their zone, the Soviets refused to relinquish any territory to France. Trying to be gallant, the Americans and the British carved a French zone out of their own sectors. The Soviets then blockaded Berlin and built the Berlin Wall, and Germany was split for the next half century. The British made Germany's war-torn economy worse by trying to impose socialism in their zone, as well as in their country. Predictably, economic disaster ensued. Over the next 5 years, the United States was required to spend the equivalent of about $200 billion annually in today's dollars to bail out Western Europe under the Marshall Plan. I note that there was no need for a Marshall Plan in Japan. And the disastrous German occupation is the best-case scenario for international peacekeeping. The less successful version includes our international peacekeeping in Somalia in 1993, leading to the corpses of American servicemen being defaced and one corpse being dragged through the streets by dancing, cheering savages. Showing that America is not a country to be toyed with, our draft-dodging, pot-smoking commander-in-chief responded by withdrawing our troops. So naturally, the Democrats are rooting for an international force in Iraq. The Democratic logic on national defense is, as soon as anyone in the military gets his hair mussed, we must pull out and bring in international peacekeeping forces. Our boys are in harm's way. People are dying. Bush lied when he said major combat operations were over. Let's run. That'll show them. It was not lost on Osama bin Laden that it took only 18 dead in Somalia for the great Satan to pull out. It should not be lost on Americans that this is what the Democrats are again demanding we do in Iraq.
December 14, 2003. Saddam Hussein is captured. It's like Christmas in December. December 17, 2003.
Say, has anyone asked Dick Gephardt if this falls under miserable failure? Obviously, we'll have to wait for all the politics to play out, but at this stage, it's hard to say which was worse for Howard Dean this week, the capture of Saddam Hussein or Al Gore's endorsement. Until Sunday, Governor Meade's big applause line in speeches has been to sneer about the Bush administration's failure to catch Saddam Hussein. It seems the governor is better at prescribing bitter pills than at swallowing them. In a speech to the Pacific Council the day after Saddam was captured, Dean nearly choked on the words, "The capture of Saddam is a good thing," before quickly adding, "But the capture of Saddam has not made America safer." Possible headline, Dean says Saddam's capture good thing, just not really good thing. If George Bush announced that a cure for cancer had been discovered, Democrats would complain about unemployed laboratory rats. On Fox News Sunday, Senator John Kerry said of Saddam's capture, "This is a great opportunity for this president to get it right for the long term, and I hope he will be magnanimous, reach out to the UN, to allies who've stood away from us." It's as if he were reading my mind. After listening to all the bellyaching from European leftists for the past 8 months, I think I speak for all Americans when I say, I've been waiting for just the right opportunity to grovel to the French. And now we have it. A major win is the perfect opportunity. That Kerry, he has an uncanny sense for what the average American is thinking. Actually, to tell the truth, he lost me with that one. Maybe it's a good opportunity for the French and the United Nations to reach out to us, but by what logic is this an opportunity for us to reach out to them? As I understand it, the situation is, we caught Saddam. So the obvious next move is, A, put him on trial, B, get information from him, C, torture him, D, turn him over to the Iraqis, E, appeal to the French. What was interesting about Kerry's suggestion was that it was the exact same suggestion liberals were making when they claimed the war was going badly. The day before Saddam's capture, the New York Times editorialized, "The way to deal with all that is going wrong in Iraq remains as clear as it was on the day that Mr. Bush declared an end to major combat operations. Instead of driving away France, Germany, Russia, and Canada with financial sanctions, the president should be creating the room for compromise." Damn that Bush. He squandered the goodwill of a bunch of people who hate our guts. I guess this is what liberals mean by a plan. Military setback, appeal to the French. Military victory, appeal to the French. Saddam captured, appeal to the French. Osama captured, appeal to the French. Osama catches Saddam, appeal to the French. In 24 months, Bush has perceptibly degraded terrorist operations throughout the world. The rebuilding in Iraq is going better than could possibly have been expected. Liberals don't care. They just want to turn everything over to the French. And apparently, the recent capture of Saddam presents us with a golden opportunity to do so. The Birchers were right about these people. They believe in world government more than they believe in the United States. One strongly suspects that the White House sat on the story of Saddam's capture for a day, so the Times could put out its regular Sunday bad news. A Baghdad neighborhood, once hopeful, now reels as Iraq's turmoil persists. Saboteurs, looters, and old equipment work against efforts to restart Iraqi oil fields. It's going to be a bloody Christmas. The New York Times hasn't looked this foolish, well, I guess since the day before. Liberals should perk up. It's not all bad news. True, Saddam Hussein has been captured, but Norman Mineta is still at large.
Al-Qaeda barks, the Spanish fly. March 17, 2004.
After a terrorist attack by Al-Qaeda that left hundreds of their fellow countrymen dead, Spanish voters immediately voted to give the terrorists what they want, a socialist government that opposes America's war on terrorism. Al-Qaeda has changed a government. Until the bombings last week, the center-right Popular Party of outgoing Prime Minister José María Anzar had been sailing to victory. But then the al-Qaeda bombs went off, and Spaniards turned out in droves to vote against the government that had been a staunch Bush ally in the war on terrorism. I guess it's okay for a Spanish socialist to politicize a terrorist attack just to get elected. In a videotaped message, the al-Qaeda...